Well, thank you very much. Good morning to all of you, and thanks for being here for this second panel. I'm very excited that we're going to be discussing the issue of the Arab Spring today, a very broad phenomenon, a very complex phenomenon with many implications for human rights and democracy. I'm Frederic Maigret, by the way. I hold the Canada Research Chair in the Law of Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. It has the same name as the center that you're familiar with. I'll just begin with just a few words of introduction. I will present each of our fantastic speakers before their presentations shortly, but of course you have their bios in the conference program. So it all started on the 4th of January 2010, at least that's the narrative, when Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia set himself on fire after he had been rebuked, after his wares had been confiscated. He was selling vegetables on the side of the road. And I don't think anyone could have foreseen the chain of events that unfolded the way social movements, revolutionary movements spread throughout the Middle East, throughout the Arab world, with a varying impact, very different consequences from one country to another. And I think one of the questions that we need to ask ourselves, because it's not as evident a question as it seems, is what provoked the Arab Spring? To what extent is the Arab Spring about human rights? To what extent is it about democracy? To what extent is it about opportunities for the young, about economic injustice, about spiking world food prices, about the fight against or frustration with corruption or nepotism? I think it's probably many of these things at the same time, but disentangling the impact that each of them had in precipitating revolutionary movements in these countries is key. The second question that is really, I think, extremely significant for the future of the region and beyond is, of course, what the Arab Spring heralds, what it promises, and what it will be able to deliver. And here we have some familiar tensions. One, of course, is the tension between revolutions as a means of political change and human rights. Revolutions tend to be messy, to provoke violence, to lead in themselves to human rights violations, but that they may sometimes be the only way forward to provoke radical change. Some have been non-violent, others have been more violent. I think one of the questions is that is emerging very strongly today is some of the tensions between a newfound democracy, a democracy that is still trying to find its path, and the human rights question, tensions between the protection of group rights and the protection of individual rights, problems of protection of religious minorities, secularism, and participation in democratic institutions. So I won't. This was just a very broad brush, and we're going to start with a presentation that is, I think, will set the regional picture, and will hopefully be backed by a PowerPoint presentation by Daniel Kallingert, who's the Executive Vice President of Freedom House, and where he oversees Freedom House's contributions to policy debates on democracy and human rights issues. I can't think of someone more appropriate to get us started this morning on this very complex topic. So, Daniel.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the conference organizers for bringing us together. I'd like to set the context for this discussion to put the Arab Spring in a broader context and then I think set the stage for discussion from our colleagues here who know individual countries much better than I. I'm presuming that most people are familiar with Freedom House ratings, but for those who aren't, just very briefly, we put out annual ratings of each country according to their political rights and civil liberties. And this is our Freedom in the World report. We also have other reports which I will refer to, but most of what I'm presenting here are the big picture assessments of freedom. Now, if we're looking at a global picture, obviously there was a big wave of democratization starting in the late 70s through the 80s, and particularly with the fall of communism that swept not only Latin America, Eastern Europe, but much of Africa and other parts of the world. That continued for a few years into the 1990s, but then we've seen essentially stagnation in the path of freedom from the mid-90s, and in the last several years, decline. So if you look at a global picture, you see that around 2005, the number of countries experiencing a decline in political rights or civil liberties was actually greater than the number of countries improving. I think this is very significant in setting the context. Another key point is that when we looked at our measures of freedom for the Middle East and North Africa specifically, they were very stagnant for decades. And you know, from an internal perspective, when we had to update the scores and review them, it was pretty much the easiest region to assess because it was pretty similar year from year. Which goes to show you just how significant and substantial the Arab opening, awakening was. I think it's fair to say it was a historic opening, both for the region and within this global context of stagnation and decline in freedom. What we've seen in particular is big advances in three countries. Now, this chart shows, it's really the top of a larger chart in which we were looking at the countries throughout the world that have experienced the biggest declines and advances in freedom. And if you look on the right-hand side, three of the five countries that have made the biggest progress in the last 5 years are from the Arab world. It's Libya, it's Tunisia, and it's Egypt. But that's only part of the picture. What about the rest of the Arab Middle East? Actually, what we've seen there is a backlash to the Arab Spring, intensified repression from existing regimes. So if we look just over the last year, many more countries experienced setbacks in freedom than advances. And if you look, this is a graphical representation. So the blue represents progress since 2011. So we see significant progress in Egypt. We see big advances in Libya and Tunisia. And the orange-red are gradations of decline. And so aside from Jordan and Qatar, all the other Arab countries have experienced some measure of decline in freedom. And again, this is the response from authoritarian regimes and sometimes very rough dictatorships, obviously most blatantly seen in Syria, a response where entrenched interests and entrenched governments are doing everything they can to stop the Arab Spring from reaching their country. Okay. Now, we also have a separate study called Countries at a Crossroads, which looks specifically at democratic governance. So we're looking more, we obviously look at electoral processes and institutions for protecting freedom of expression and freedom of association, but also measures of controlling corruption and governance more generally. And this study was very interesting in giving a deeper perspective on what is happening within the Arab world. And what it showed is that countries in the Middle East, going back several years, had very big institutional deficits. They had weak institutions to begin with. Now, part of the weakness of those institutions helps explain the change. So for instance, the kind of police brutality that brought out the cases in Tunisia and Egypt, which really inflamed public sentiment and made average people feel that, you know, we could get beat up on the street any day and nothing will happen. That's how citizens are treated. You know, that's a reflection of the absence of rule of law, of a police and security forces that are serving narrow interests rather than serving the public. But the flip side of that means that those are the institutions that, frankly, are still in place today. And even in the best case scenario of Tunisia, the reforms of the judiciary, of the police, and so on, have just barely begun. So even in the best case scenario, it's going to be a very long road ahead, because you cannot promote justice, you cannot have systems in place that protect human rights unless you carry out those institutional reforms. To give you a closer focus on two countries, Tunisia, and I'll get to Egypt. And these are, the measures of democratic governance. And keep in mind, Tunisia is the best case scenario of the Arab awakening. I know it looks like a bunch of colored spaghetti, but if you can get beyond that, the blue line shows accountability and public voice. So essentially, an electoral system, a governance system that responds to citizen demands. And there we've seen a very dramatic increase in Tunisia. And by our measures, you see the heavier dotted line at 5. That's essentially the threshold of a democracy. So they have, by our measure, built a democratic electoral system. According to other measures, so civil liberties, you know, protection of free expression and association, rule of law, anti-corruption, transparency measures, they've made improvements, but obviously they have a ways to go. Now, contrast that with Egypt. And essentially, in Egypt, we see some progress on accountability and public voice. So essentially, they've had a couple of elections which are certainly huge improvements over the elections during the Mubarak era, and, you know, generally competitive. But by other measures, they're essentially still flatlined. And you can tell because, you know, they haven't started any of the fundamental reforms. And you see, you know, day to day, you see evidence of that. You see the, you know, the harsh and violent crackdown on protests. You have cases of, you know, most recently the uproar is over minors who've not only been detained but tortured. And these are documented cases. And not only that, but the response of officials is, well, that's better than it was under Mubarak. So clearly it is an unreformed system. And I think that is the biggest challenge of, you know, creating a context that will allow and protect human rights. I actually have more to say, but I think I will leave it here and save other comments for the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, General, for this introduction. The next speaker is Yara Salam from Egypt, who is the director of the Women Human Rights Defenders Program at Nasra for Feminist Studies. She's been working on women's rights issues in Egypt for a long time, and was involved in particular in the publication of a manual on women human rights defenders in 2012.
Yeah. Good evening, everyone. Good morning. I'm sorry.
I'm
jet lagged. 6 hours now in Egypt before. First, I want to thank everyone from the conference who helped me come here, and I feel more like home. Usually, I start such presentations with a timeline of the violations against women human rights defenders, but today I decided to start with the good news. This month, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights decided that Egypt is in violation of the African Charter for a case that was filed 7 years ago. In 2005, during Mubarak's time, there was an event called the Black Wednesday, There were amendments to the Egyptian constitution, and there were journalists, female journalists, were sexually attacked while protesting against the amendments. There was a very formal investigation about the case. There were no justice to the survivors. And a human rights organization decided to take the case to the African Commission in 2006. 2009, one of them died from cancer. And now, after 8 years, now there's justice. We're not sure yet what the Egyptian government will do, but I believe that this is a success, and it makes me proud as an African woman that such a human rights body decided on this case. Just to continue with the timeline, if I may say, so that was in 2005, during Mubarak's time. 2011, March, the army conducted virginity testing on protesters, female protesters. One or two of them only spoke up to media and filed the case before the Administrative Court of Justice. They won the case. The court said this is not acceptable to be done in any way to women. The criminal investigation, it was before the military court. They lost. December 2011, also the military dispersed a sit-in before the cabinet, the Egyptian cabinet. Women were also sexually assaulted. They were tortured. I personally attended the investigations with them. One of them was not able to walk from the torture. In June, we started having mass sexual harassment. We've always been having sexual harassment issues. Like when I heard about India, I completely felt connected with this fact. Since the 90s, and we're having a problem with sexual harassment in the streets, we have no idea about statistics in the workplace. In June, it was the first thing that happens during protests. So we were a little bit shocked. I was lucky to meet the three survivors who've been through this this accident, and I've been talking to them. We published their testimonies, and we thought that this is it. It will not happen again. Of course, they did not report, because we have no faith in the Egyptian police to bring justice to us. November and December 2012, the events happened again, but the survivors decided not to talk. They came to us and for medical support, and they said, we don't want to talk about it, so we didn't say anything. January 2013, in the event of celebrating our revolution, there were gang rapes in the square, two of which were raped by sharp weapons. They were all in the same manner. They were organized criminal groups. All of the survivors were recounting the same testimonies all over again, how it starts with like 10 men and continues up to 50 or hundreds of men doing the same techniques. And then now we have Shura Council, which is now the responsible for legislating laws. And within it, there's a discussion that says that the women are responsible for it, that they are asking for it to start with. We have a prime minister, Hisham Andil, who comes out publicly a couple of months ago saying that the government is not responsible for securing protests, that it's up to the citizens, the people who are actually taking part of the protest, to secure it and complete the disregard to Egypt's international obligation. So what's with the situation of women at the moment, other than the attacks on their presence in the public sphere? In the first parliament after the revolution, we had 9 women out of 508 seats. Two of them were appointed from the military, and the other 7 were from the election themselves. We had a majority of 37.5% from the Freedom and Justice Party. We had 27.8% from a Noor Party, and the rest were kind of civil groups. I just want to to say that the Freedom and Justice Party are not like a Noor Party, because everyone tend to put them together in one basket saying these are the Islamists. But from my point of view and from what we saw the last couple of years, they are not the same. The Freedom and Justice Party or the Muslim Brotherhood, who actually now are an official organization, civil society organization, that was announced 2 days ago, are not the extremist groups in Egypt. They are quite like Mubarak. They're actually, I believe that Morsi is the same as him, except with a beard and with the words of God. But An-Nur are the ones who are actually more radical than them. So it's always good to put them in perspective. Morsi actually was in the parliament. He served as a parliamentarian from 2000 to 2005. He was then arrested on the 28th of January 2011 during the uprising. And he's been president since June 2012. And ever since he took power, he's not doing anything except to settle his own men around him in different positions. So many civil society organizations have proposed laws to restructure the Ministry of Interior, to end police brutality and torture. Nothing in this regard has happened. The constitution, the new constitution that we have, I don't know if many of you have read it, but I'm a lawyer, and it seems completely ridiculous to me. Women are mentioned as sisters to men. They are mentioned as that the state has to make sure they balance their obligations in the family and with work, which completely eradicate the fact that some women don't want to have families or they want to stay alone. And the abolition, the criminalization of sex work, instead of talking about early marriage, they criminalize sex work. And there's nothing related to equality. There's a provision in the preamble that says there should not be any discrimination. There's nothing about equality between men and women as per se. When we talk about democracy or peaceful protests, this puts us in a weird position at the moment in Egypt when protesters are turning violent. When there is an absence of accountability for the crimes that have been committed, whether under Mubarak, whether during the 18 days, or under SCAF rule, the army, or since Morsi started ruling the country, you start to question which human rights are you advocating for? Like, how can you talk to someone who had like a brother or sister who've been murdered, and they've been trying for years and years, not years and years, okay, there are 3 years only, to do something about it, but no one is actually responding, and they can't really see any positive steps. So this puts really human rights organizations in Egypt at a stake, because sometimes we always work in the framework of human rights and peaceful protests, but then the protesters actually start, they do not always start, but they defend themselves with bullets from the police. So this is a question I would like to ask generally, like what can we do? What is our approach to this kind of response to lack of accountability? I think I'll stop here and then, we'll continue. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for that testimony. And we'll obviously, all of these issues we'll have plenty of time to discuss further later on. The next speaker is a Palestinian journalist who is currently Bassem Eid, who is currently the director of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group. You used to work as a senior field worker for B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights NGO, and you've received many awards for your human rights work in Palestine.
Thank you very much. I will leave the all thanks for my friend Radwan later on here. I would like to start from Yara stopped. And Mubarak is a very interesting case, by the way, in the whole Arab Spring, with the old crimes, in my opinion, that he committed against his people and against the region in general. I remember everybody, probably, or most of you remember the Egyptian human rights activist Saad al-Din Ibrahim. When he was arrested by Mubarak regime and brought, for the state security court at midnight, and he was sentenced for 7 years imprisonment. Few weeks later, the former U.S. President George W. Bush decided to send Ms. Condoleezza Rice, the former U.S. Secretary, directly to Mubarak to discuss the case of Saadeddine Ibrahim. She went and she met with Mubarak. She started talking, you know, about democracy, human rights, reforms. And after half an hour speaking from Ms. Rice to Mubarak, what Mubarak answered her? He said, listen, Ms. Rice, you should have to start looking for another dictatorship after my death. This is the answer that Hosni Mubarak gave to Ms. Rice after the arrest of Saadeddine Ibrahim. Now, on the other side, I am not blaming our president, Mahmoud Abbas, last month when he participated in the Islamic countries summit. You know how he called Mohammed Morsi? He called him Mohammed Mubarak. So still, you know, each dictator will remember the other and would like to continue remembering the other. Now, towards the Arab Spring, I can conclude it just in a few words. In my opinion, that there are so many challenges yet. On the other side, there is no effects until now. But there is one consequence from the Arab Spring, that the oppressed people became oppressors. And this is what we hear from Yara about Mohammed Morsi, how long he spent in the Egyptian jail during Mubarak regime. Now, I am an Arab, I am a Muslim also. But I think that the Arab Spring will never be able to bring any changes to the region until the Arab culture, first of all, should have to be changed. And I am calling from here the all Arab intellectual people around the world to stand up and to start their own revolutionary in terms to change the culture, first of all. Probably we will be able to change the regime. And I believe in some of the Arab countries, the people succeed to get rid from the oppressors. But the same people are still living under the same dictatorship institutions. What's changed in Egypt? Can you tell me, please? It is two faces for the same currency, if it is Mohammed Morsi or Mohammed Mubarak. It is the same. So, how long it's going to take? In my opinion, it's going to be a long-term revolutionary. Nothing ended in Egypt, nothing ended in Tunisia, nothing ended in Libya. Still, these countries became as a big cows, in my opinion. Now, don't tell me that I am, as a human rights activist, I am the person who can guarantee the rights of the people. Of course not. I can protect the rights of the people, but I couldn't guarantee the rights of the people. Who can, the only one, guarantee the rights of the people? Only an independent, free judiciary. This is what we are looking for. In the Arab countries, including the Arab Spring countries, there is no an independent free judiciary. Violations for human rights will continue. Now, to all of my colleagues, the human rights activists, I must have to tell them that as there are soldiers guarding and protecting borders, there are also soldiers guarding and protecting the rights of their own people. And we are proud on such kind of mission. Now, I want a little bit to go to Syria and the international community. In my opinion, the international community foreign policy towards Syria has a kind of a double standard. Why the NATO decided to interfere in Libya and leaving Bashar al-Assad, who is, in my opinion, the Hitler of the 21st century, killing every day between 100 to 200 civilians, innocent people. Where is the international community? Upon the arrival of Mr. Obama to Israel 2 days ago, one of the Israeli journalists asked Obama that you don't, Mr. Obama, think that the using of the chemical in Syria is crossing lines of Bashar al-Assad? And the international community already did nothing in the past. Is the international community going to take action after the using of the chemicals? Then Mr. Obama decided to answer half of the question from where he started, when the journalist said that the international community did nothing to Syria until now. Then he said, what you are saying is incorrect. We almost gave hundreds of millions of dollars during the U.S. aid to the Syrian people. We are feeding some of the Syrian people daily. Come on, excuse me. Are the Syrians looking for somebody to feed them or to liberate them? Excuse me. You are the president of the greatest country in the world. Is such answer you are giving me that you are feeding me? I never asked you for food. I ask you to help me to get rid from such kind of a dictatorship. Now, the international community has a kind of a double standard. I don't think that Germany has the same policy towards Syria like France or like Norway. So the Syrian people has a real problem with the international community. How we can save the lives of the innocent people who are killed for nothing every day in Syria? I think that one of the conclusions of a such kind important conference should have to come out by a huge cry to the international community, please help, help, help the Syrian people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I didn't know you were going to speak about Syria, but this is clearly the topic that Radwan Ziadeh will be addressing. Radwan is the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies in Syria. He's currently based in Washington, and he's involved, as I learned from our discussions, in an early, maybe precocious, but I'm sure quite necessary effort to think about the conditions of transitional justice in Syria.
Thank you very much for the organizer for such an important event. And thank Bassem for actually making the introduction. But let me start with a broad overview about the Arab Spring, because actually the understanding of the dynamics within the Arab Spring, which allow us to understand more the situation in Syria. The Arab Spring, it has actually three major players. In every country, the scenarios in each country depends on these three major players. The first one is the army, the national army, and the second one, the revolutionary groups and the opposition forces, and the third one, the international community. And how these three players played in each country different role than the outcome of the Arab Spring, which still very early, of course, to judge the outcomes of. Because I call this is this is an Arab transformation. This is, I call it, this is the fifth wave of democratizations, as Samuel Huntington mentioned, the fourth wave of democratization, and Daniel mentioned about that. And this is why the domino effect was clear from the day one. When it started in Tunisia, moved to the Tahrir Square, which is the largest Arab country, with too much media attention, where Al Jazeera and CNN and Tahrir Square 24 hours, which we call it, this is the God's Eye, which protect all the revolution is there from any attacks by the government, with the whole pressure from the international community, allow the revolution to end in Egypt in less than 18 days. Then that's clear for the, it will move to Libya, which is the hardest case, then in Yemen, then the difficulties was in Syria. In all these five countries, they have a lot of similarities, with the same time, a lot of differences. I mean, it started with Tunisia, the most educated society among the Arab countries. It has 25% Facebook users, which a lot, then it's this is, and also a very, very educated and very well connected to the West, especially to France. And with the same time, they have good assets in administrative institutions. It's not like the situation in Libya or in Yemen or in Syria. This is why the success of the revolution in Tunisia in less than 31 days, they open the promises to start it in Egypt. The national army in Tunisia played a very important role, protect the protesters, then step aside. The revolutionary councils and the opposition forces, they set up an agreement which called what's called the Council for to Protect the Revolution, which include all the secularists and the Islamists. And this is the game which it was dangerous to start to play in within. These differences has to be discussed and negotiated. We should not all these ideologies to put aside right now, because we are starting to build an institution, and should all institutions has to be inclusive. And this is why the Tunisian, the Muslim Brothers, even the Ennahda Party, which is part of branch of the Muslim Brothers, played an important role to reach out to the other groups. And also at that time, the international community also played a minor role. Then we'll go to Egypt. The army played the same role, but he decided not to step aside like in Tunisia. Has to play a role at least to protect the assets, and has a huge economic interest in Egypt. And this is, they have self-interest, and this is why the transformation in Egypt was back and forth. Until now, this is the same case. With the in Libya and in Syria, where the army played the negative role. In Libya, it helped that the international community acted very quickly. After 7 days from the February 17th, when it was clear the security forces of al-Qaddafi start attacking the peaceful protest, the Security Council adopted the Resolution 1970, which referred the crimes against humanity, war crimes, to the ICC. And after 30 days, where the continue of attackings, especially we are very close to what's called the Benghazi massacre, the Security Council again adopted the resolution 1973, which actually historic resolution, because it was the first one mentioned responsibility to protect by using all the necessary measures to protect the civilians. Then it was the international community acted very quickly. We thought that this will be a sign for the Assad regime, because if the Assad regime understand that this is not the 90s, where the Assad, the father of the current president, killed more than 25,000 in Hama and no response. This is what's called Hama rules, which allows such dictatorship to last for a long time. Now we are living in different international world. But we are wrong, because what started as a peaceful revolution in the southern city of Daraa, and people chanting for dignity and human rights, the international community was failed until now to adopt a resolution. What's more insulting, that's the role, that the three roles are different. Then first, The National Army, Syria has one of the largest army in the world, number 16th in large. It has more than 400,000 soldiers and officers. And because it built such during these 40 years, because Syria, it's called itself, it's a war with Israel, and it get help from Arab Gulf countries at that time to have this huge deals of arms. This is why they have much more long-range missiles than any Arab countries, or any even that in the region. And this is why it's building all this state source. If the army and the Assad regime decided to use all of these state sources against the Syrian people, as I said many times, Syria will be the hell itself. The Assad has more than 400 Scud missiles. If he decided to use all of this long-range missiles against the Syrian people, until now, he used 91. If he decided to use all of them, and of course there is no indication by the international community even that to do any red lines for the Assad use, daily use of these missiles. The Assad, of course, has sources of chemical and biological weapons. And there is not clear indication of using that. But for the Syrians, it's the same if you be killed by chemical weapons or by Air Force or fighter jets, all of that. This is why the role of that of the army play a negative role in Syria. What's who can make the balance? The international community. The international community decided here not to play any role. Even that, it's very interesting. We still use this war. The international community, I know there is a lot of debate and discussion about this war, because when I heard also Ban Ki-moon, who is the Secretary General of the UN, always saying in his statements the role of the international community. We consider you as the international community, and he's saying to us that the role of the international community. The same time when Vice President Biden, when he was in Munich, and he said that there is a role for the international community to play. We believe that the United States is the superpower and which can play an important role in the international community. It's always that send a wrong message to the Syrian people that the international community decided not to play a role. And Syria here is not like a unique case. We have many cases before in history where the international community decided not to play a role and to keep things like this. We have Rwanda before. We have Bosnia 1994, Kosovo 1999. But after 2002, where the ICC International Criminal Court established, and after 2005, where the responsibility to protect has been adopted, and Canada played an important role in this regard at the UN, we thought that such kind of regimes should not be allowed or should not be waived by the international community, should be at least red lines, should be implied for responsibility to protect. But Syria right now telling us a different story. I don't want to go to the numbers, because the numbers is many times did not give us the story, the real story for each human being, each human one. As example, I'm from Daraya. It's a city very close to Damascus, 7 kilometers. Of course, I lost two of my cousins. I lost 64 colleagues, friends. I lived with them. I grew up with them. And more of that, because the city has strategic location very close to the Damascus, where very close to the security complex. The population of the city is 240,000. Only 2,000 now staying in the city. All of that refugees. My mother in Turkey, my brother in Jordan, other sister in Lebanon, and the whole family being spread in all the world. This is not only a one family. We are telling the stories of 3 million Syrians being refugees or being displaced inside the country. More of that, of course, the injured people, which they need an urgent assistance, and of course, the people who been lost their beloved one, they need a help, they need assistance, and all of that, and this is why telling us only one side of the story, where the international community, in some cases, decided to be blind or to be silent, then the situation became more difficult. What we have in the story in the media right now, all the story of the extremists, the jihadists, and all of that, is nothing strange. Always I say this is predictable. When you leave things like that, of course the radicalizations will be the only voice, because the people, they are looking for anything to defend themselves, to help them, and this is the case. I visited Syria after 5 years. I left Syria in 2007. I left Syria after 5 years from the northern border through Turkey, and I met one of in the city of Aleppo. I met one of the children. He's 7 years old. He lost off his family members by one of the strikes of the fighter jets, which the Assad regime used this fighter jets very heavily in the northern part. We call this part of the country as liberated areas, but still being attacked, still being targeted by the long-range missiles and the airstrikes. And he asked me only one question, which I difficult to answer. Why the world is leaving us like this? He thought that something is difficult for him to understand, because he's very young. That's why he'd been killed. He was only only standing on the breadline, where actually there is a good report by the Human Rights Watch how the Assad airstrikes target 26 breadlines in Homs and Aleppo. And for him, very difficult to understand what someone waiting to get bread, why he has to lose all his family members. I just told him myself, very difficult to understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to take a few minutes just to have a panel discussion, and maybe I'll address different questions to different members of the panel. The first question is to Danielle. In terms of possible scenarios for the future of the Arab Spring, obviously each country is very different from the other. I was thinking, based on your previous experience, particularly in Eastern Europe, and some of the scenarios that are plausible based on that experience. There's an Iranian scenario also that's sometimes mentioned, that the idea that we have a revolutionary movement that is, in essence, sort of liberal or, you know, whatever, secular, left-wing, etc., that's hijacked by religious parties along the way. Is that plausible? There's a volcanic or Russian scenario where, or at least a volcanic scenario where the break with the past manifests itself in the case of the Balkans in nationalism and in renewed violence, but after a rather long transitional phase, there's a kind of more for liberal normalization. And there's a Russian scenario where there's a change, and then not much of a change. It seems as if it's of course different politics, but the no real democratic change in terms of the centralization of power and kind of authoritarian governance. So of those, and maybe others that you can think of, South America is also interesting. What are the most promising? What are the ones that might have lessons to yield for the Middle East?
Right. I think my short answer would be we are likely to see different scenarios in different places. The Iran scenario, I think, is quite remote. There is, you know, if you're looking at the role of Islamist political parties, the more optimistic alternative would be, let's say, the Indonesia scenario, where you have a range of Islamist parties, and they go from very conservative to quite moderate. But I think as important is that there are three major Islamist parties that voters have to choose from. So even within that spectrum or sphere, there is pluralism, there is choice for the citizens. And what tends to happen over time is that the more conservative elements do well initially because they can offer simple solutions, and in many cases they have an easy tagline to address endemic corruption, as in they say, we're religious, so we're cleaner than the other guys. But you know, once that is tested, it usually doesn't work as well as advertised. And so the more conservative Islamist parties tend to do less well with each subsequent election. The Balkan scenario, you know, in some senses, it's already happening in Syria, or it's getting quite close. But that is, you know, that's happening in the absence of any democracy. I mean, that's really the result of both squashing a peaceful pro-democracy movement, which, you know, it was largely nonviolent for about 9 months. And it's amazing the resilience of the Syrian people, not just now, but even during that period when they were being shot at peaceful demonstrators day in, day out. And, you know, they tried everything they could to keep that nonviolent. The Russian scenario, I think, is in some cases most likely because it's sort of the default. It goes back to my earlier discussion of that you need institutional changes to really bring about and solidify democracy, but you have all these entrenched interests, and you need enough of a political consensus and momentum to bring about reform. And absent that, you'll default into, I like Bassem's comments about, you know, it's the same institutions of dictatorship or different faces. I mean, the institutional legacy is very powerful, not just in the Middle East, but historically and in all these kinds of scenarios. I do want to add a comment about the momentum for change, and especially if you look at the difference between Tunisia and Egypt. And I would say one of the very big and in some ways fundamental differences is that in Tunisia, and recognizing that big challenges ahead, still serious problems in many regards, but there was a consensus about the roadmap for change. In other words, from the very early days of the revolution, there was pretty much a consensus behind the process of elect a constituent assembly first, focus on not, you know, you needed that first the Ben Ashour Commission, then the constituent assembly to run things day to day, but essentially put off big political decisions, but essentially get an elected body, focus on writing a constitution, have an electoral system that is pluralistic. I mean, their emphasis on proportional representation meant that the Islamists weren't as strong in the outcome as, say, the Muslim Brothers and the Salafist groups in Egypt. And that essentially meant everyone agreed on the rules of the game. And so once you get that consensus, then you can get a system that people agree to operate in, and then you can decide, you know, do we want more emphasis on religion, more on secular institutions, and so on. A big problem in Egypt is they never agreed on the rules of the game. And in some ways, they're still debating that. They had, in the early months of the revolution, you had some saying, you know, write a constitution first and then elect an assembly. And others saying, no, you need a popular mandate for a constituent assembly that will then write a constitution. What you've had happen, and you see the problems, is that, you know, they elected a president who comes, you know, with a legacy of a strong presidency. You have a, let's say, on again, off again, you know, elected parliament that then gets dissolved by the courts before they've written a constitution that says what are the powers of the presidency. So obviously in that, it's a bit strong to say it's an institutional vacuum, but people haven't agreed on basic rules like how strong should the presidency be. And that, I think, leads to all these other problems that get you far away from the kind of institutional reforms to really make democracy happen.
So plenty of thoughts that come to mind, but one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was you reminded us that the the Syrian revolution was nonviolent for the longest time. And I think this is today one of the dividing lines between different processes of the extent to which they've resorted to violence, and sort of often reminded we live in a kind of post 9/11 era where sort of there's a lot of skepticism about non-state actors using violence, and this is something that the Syrian regime uses a lot. The terrorism label to brand any opposition as terroristic. One of the things I was wondering, and this is addressed to all speakers, I suppose, is when you see, do you see a tipping point, a point when the case for violence becomes justified for revolutionary violence? And obviously have Syria and Libya in mind particularly, or will that have been part of a problem? This legacy of violence will then make it very difficult to establish the foundations for democracy.
Yes. Let me hear by three points. Why the Arab Spring will be quite different than the scenario of Iran, especially for the role of the international community. The absence in the Arab transformation is the lack of the regional institutions can dedicate or to set the rules of democracy like what played the European Union played for the Eastern Europe. That set the rules, the indications, and all of that. The Arab League is a very weak institutions and has no power, even that it's not democratic itself. Then this is why we always call actually for the European Union, for the United States, the international community to play an active role to protect actually the newborn democracies in the Arab region. And this is the first point. But what's the optimistic part, that because the Arab region, we are not talking about very isolated. It's the Middle East, the middle of the world. And they have a huge trade, northern part or southern, in the south. This is why it has a back and forth and effective. It's in Egypt or in Libya or Tunisia. They don't have the internal sources to say we are not interested to have any conversation or negotiations. The biggest part trade with all the Arab region is the European Union. This is why the European Union, they should have influence, and they have negotiations to set all the rules and the institutions. The second issue regarding your question of the violence, if we compare Syria to Libya, I visited Libya actually after the fall of the Gaddafi, and amazed how the people there, they decided just very quickly to take arms because they understand that al-Qaddafi, there is no other language can understand, we have to use force. No, in Syria, quite different. In Syria, it takes at least 9 months. I remember I testify at the UN Human Rights Council four times for the special session on Syria. The first one was on April 17th. The number of people being killed there, it's 420. The second one was 2,200. It's that the number was rising very quickly, and the international community just watching, condemning. There is no action to protect the civilians. And after nine months, the people decided why we go to protest peacefully, and there is no radical, there is no real or meaningful change within the Assad regime. What the Assad regime promised, he removed the state of emergency, which was Syria under on for more than 40 years. How you can actually remove state of emergency and continue killing the people? It's the people, they see that this is meaningless, all these steps by the Assad regime. And this is why they lost the faith that international community can help them, lost the faith that the Assad can do real change. And this is why they decided to take arms, first of all, to defend themselves. And this is why in all the statements of the Free Syrian Army in the first 6 months of 2011, 2012, that we are using the arms only to protect the peaceful demonstrations, not to make any offensive on the Assad security forces. And we have a quite number of cases, like the case of Riyad Matar. Riyad Matar is a friend of mine from my city, Daraya. The Washington Post called him as a Gandhi of the Syrian revolution. He is 23 years old. He used to go with all the protests by red flowers, along with the Battle of Water. And he brought all of them by himself, by his own money, and give it to the security and to the army that to send the message to them that we are brothers and we need to build a new Syria. Month later, the Air Force security, they arrest him along with his friend and torture him to death. And which more difficult, the sadism among the Assad regime, that the guy who tortured him to death, he called his mother. And we have actually tape for the conversation by phone and ask her, does his right has nothing? She said no. He said to her, because I broke it very easily. He was actually torturing the mother by phone. And secondly, he sent the body of Riyad Matar to her, see that's all the blood in her system. That one, I was in Tunisia at that time when they told me the story. I was clear for me that this is such kind of regime, difficult to understand by different language. But after 2 months from the death of Riyad Matar, which was a tipping point for the Syrian revolution, because his case was quite familiar nationwide, everyone understand that we have to do something. If we decided we can give up, like we did in the 80s, we can give up, and the Assad regime can crush the revolution. And we got what we got? We got statements, tears from the international community. Or we can take our rights by our hands. And this is what's happened. And this is why it was, the first 6 months was good, because at least convinced, because Syrian society, it's very diverse. We have Christian, Druze, Alawite. By peaceful demonstration, convince all of these groups that we are all together, we need to build a new Syria, a new democratic Syria. And this is the message the first 6 months sent out. But later on, the people decided that the international community can do nothing for them. The Assad regime will not help them in any way to have, we have an initiative at that time, we ask actually Bashar al-Assad to lead the transition. Like what's happening in Spain and in Greece and other countries in the early 70s, but he decided to go in the path of Gaddafi.
So I have a couple more questions. One of them actually is for Yara, and I think this tension that we're seeing in Egypt, where democracy just doesn't seem to translate into human rights for all. At least there's a kind of distributive impact that former political prisoners are now in power, and their rights are better guaranteed, obviously, and there's political participation, but then the rights of women and religious minorities, for example, are threatened. And that's obviously a tension we're familiar with, the risk of oppressive majorities. What's the feeling about among sort of women's rights activists in Egypt right now in terms of a best strategy? Is how far does the invocation of international human rights, for example, get you with the current government? We discussed briefly before that the Muslim Brotherhood came up with a very hostile statement to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Is there any temptation to use your association with, let's say, sort of human rights sources as, to suggest that you're, too Western or, not un-Egyptian? Is there a strategy that says, actually, these debates ought to be perhaps simultaneously or more significantly taken up from within an Islamic tradition or theological tradition? So I just wanted to hear your thoughts a bit on these strategies.
Sure. First of all, there's no such, there's not a big difference between the current regime and Mubarak's regime in terms of Egypt has been the bad guy leading the African bloc, the OIC bloc, and the Arab bloc within the Human Rights Council and within the African Union. Our ambassador, our lovely ambassador in the Human Rights Council is still the same. They're leading Egypt's effort to strangle everything related to women's rights. There have been a resolution tabled for protection of family, along with Russia and other lovely countries to my heart. Governments, I mean, I don't mean countries. So there has been, this has been the policy of Egypt for years. They've been opposing anything related to sexual orientation and gender identity, anything related to abortion, anything related to talking about women as equal citizens rather than a member of a family, a sister, a mother, or anything else. The difference now is that they're becoming quite aggressive in different venues. So, for example, the statement that you're mentioning in the CSW, in the beginning, there's even a tension inside, and I agree with you, there's no consensus about anything at the moment in Egypt, whether of political or anything else. The person who is leading the Egyptian delegation in the CSW, Pakinem Aymer, she's a presidential consultant. She's a consultant for Morsi. Before, she went one day before the delegation was formed, because before that, the head of the National Council for Women was the one heading the delegation, who had a wide consultation with civil society organizations about what to do in the CSW. So this gives us a huge sign that there will be actually a bigger attack on the international venues about women's issues, which from my side, I think we should act accordingly. We should act on the same level as their aggression. We're always being accused about being Westerners, whether to talk about human rights or to talk about anything else, anything that is not their point of view. I wouldn't take this. I wouldn't be blackmailed. And when I speak to friends or colleagues from different Western countries, I tell them like, you should not be blackmailed because you're Westerners. Human rights was not negotiated by Americans only or Europeans only. It's been negotiated by people from all over the globe. And Canadian women are equal to Egyptian women, are equal to Mexican women, are equal to all women. I don't think there's no culture or justification to say that people are less equal. The only difference with the Mubarak regime is that they were friends. They're so much friends with the Western community. Suzanne Mubarak has always been the advocate of women's rights, which now we have a problem with because she created the whole thing about state feminism, which now when we speak about women's rights or feminism, that brings back to the public that we're actually the Mubarak's people. So, for example, the huge campaign, she mobilized everyone about the criminalization of female genital mutilation. We have over 90% of women, Egyptian women, who've been through this harmful practice. Now, the percentage is not less than 90%, because she'd done that just to please the West, to say that we're very progressive, we protect women's rights. Now, in the penal code, we have a prohibition. But on the ground, did she do anything? She didn't. It's just a facade in front of everyone that she's doing a great job. But I'm optimistic because I don't think that change is restricted to the regime itself. The structure of the institutions themselves are very strong. It's been years and years since Nasser. It was a military coup. For people who love Nasser, they would say a revolution, but I don't any. It's not. It's a military coup at the end of the day. So it's really difficult, and I emphasize on Professor Naim's talk, and I don't like the Arab Spring term for that matter, because it's like, hurry up, it's the spring, it's over, you have to finish up fast, you have to do this and this and this. But I can't think of any revolution that was finished in a springtime or something. So I think there is change. There is a change in those countries that people stood up. I still remember when I was a law student, when protesters were only 20 people. We all knew each other from leftist families, friends, coming on the press syndicate. And that was it. We were 20 or 30 people. We all knew each other from the same families, people who've been in jail in Nasser's time. Now we have millions. We have people who are actually taking the streets for different reasons, for economic and social and cultural reasons. And I think this is change. I don't think that we should restrict that to the state institutions being changed, because this will not change in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years.
Fantastic. I'm reminded there's another reason why you might not want to call it spring, which is that the two other famous springs of the 1848, you know, Spring of the People and the Prague Spring, neither of which were more like autumns or winters. Yeah. Right. So hopefully, maybe we should work on the term. Maybe I have a question for Bassem in relation to Syria and you know, what the international community can do. I think the Syrians themselves, I mean, in the opposition, have been split on at the beginning, and the position's changing, but on what the proper role of the international community should be. And I can't help noticing that we just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War and the invasion of Iraq, which is not generally hailed as a considerable democratic success. And I was wondering, you know, if there is to be an international intervention, what form do you think it could take? What are the risks that it would actually make matters worse? You know, especially in a region that has a long history of outside interventions, particularly in the 20th century and before.
I think that it will be a little bit difficult for the international community here to take a specific action against what's going on, for one reason, because the old Arab dictators has been built by the international community. Excuse me, not by me, by the international community. Yeah, President Obama yesterday visited Ramallah. Did he mention the human rights to Abbas or Palestinian prisoners in Ramallah almost tortured? Of course not. Of course not. He talked about peace process, about negotiating the Israelis, about how much money we should have to prepare for you at the end of the month. That's it. So these dictators has been built by the international community. Excuse me. Now, what is the international community can do? In my opinion, not so much. Not so much. I said it in several occasions, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is very easy to solve it, believe me, but without the international community. Leave the international community outside, because each one from the international community has his own interest. They are giving money, a lot of money, but they are collecting all of the money at the end of the year. This is the international community. Now, I want to know exactly what the international community really demanding from the Arabs. What they want from us. Tell me. No one tried to tell me. You know, in 2007, by sudden, I participated in a big conference in Czech Republic. And by sudden, while I'm speaking, a huge person entered to the hall of the conference, which was George W. Bush. And after my speech, one of his advisors came to me, and he said, listen, Mr. President, want to meet with you. Then I hesitated to meet or not to meet. Am I a lucky person or unlucky person to meet with Bush? Yeah. Then I said, you know, let's do it. You know, the president of the greatest country in the world. Now, when I met with him, I said, Mr. President, I don't want to talk with you about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let us talk about Iraq. I have a good solution for you in Iraq. Then he called the advisors and he said, listen, Mr. Eid has a solution for Iraq. Come and listen to him. Then I said, Mr. President, Iraq should have to be divided to six different states, Turkmen, Shia, Sunnis, Kurdish, everyone wants his own state. After you will dividing Iraq to six different states, you can call it the United States of Iraq. Now, he pulled me back and he said, no, we should have to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Then he asked me a question, Bassem, did you remember how many times Yasser Arafat met with Bill Clinton? I said, of course I remember, 22 times. Then he said, correct. Did you get state? I said, unfortunately not. Then he said, I am the deliverer of the Palestinian state. Then I said, oh, Mr. President, when that will happen? Then he answered me in Arabic, inshallah. Then I said, all the time we said, by the American administration. So if it is going to be, by God's help, no Palestinian state will be founded. So this is the leaders, yeah? These are the leaders, how they are trying, you know, to attract you from time to time mm-hmm. on what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The floor is now open for questions. So if you can please stand to one of the microphones, I can see two, and just say who you are before you ask your question. Yes, please. Come forward. Thank you.
My name is Fazia Saeed. I'm from Pakistan, and I have a question anybody can answer. I want to know your opinion on the role of Saudi Arabia, because talking about international community, it is kind of odd for me that United States is very close buddies with Saudi Arabia, with most of the terrorists coming from there, and most of the militant groups in Pakistan being funded from there, and their role in Bahrain and Yemen. So I just want your opinion on that, because rarely people talk about Saudi Arabia in democracy conferences.
Thank you very much. We're going to take one or two more. So.
Yeah, I just had a question about, I know that Syria hosted many of the refugees from Iraq during the conflict there, and I don't really see a lot in the news about how the Syrian civil war is really affecting them. Did they mostly return to Iraq? Are they tied up? Are they re-migrating again? And because there's been very little coverage, I was hoping that you all might speak to that to the extent of your knowledge on that subject.
A third.
We talked a lot about what's going on in Syria, and not a lot has been said about. Everybody is fighting against Assad. We talked a lot about the Assad regime. Nobody's really mentioned the sizable population of Syria that is pro-Assad or anti-Assad, if you will. And I think we really need to start talking about the reconciliation process when the civil war, when the conflict is over, because you know there have been a lot of people who are fighting against and for in all of the Arab countries. And the reconciliation process hasn't really been talking. Who is going to take over, and how are the people going to reconcile as Sunnis, as Shias, as Alawites and Druze in Syria after the conflict is over?
Where are you from?
My name is Megan. I'm actually an intern at Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. I'm Canadian.
Thank you.
We'll take that afterwards. There's already a lot to cover. We'll have a second round of questions. So who wants to start?
Please, Yara.
Saudi Arabia.
This is the first country that your president visited, by the way.
Of course, my beloved president. I would tell you one example about Saudi Arabia, or more about the Gulf countries in relation to Egypt's current status. We have a law that is being in discussion at the moment at the Shura Council about civil society organizations, which prohibits foreign funding from going into human rights organizations, which, if passed, we will have a complete shutdown of independent human rights organizations, the local ones and the international ones. Excluded from this funding is funding from the Arab countries, which pose questions about funding from Saudi Arabia, funding from Qatar. And now that we have an officially civil society organization for the Muslim Brotherhood, it's not prohibited anymore. Then now we can think about what kind of money is going into the country, to whom, and the other organizations as well, how it's going to affect their work. So mainly for me, it's about the funding concerning Saudi Arabia, the effect on how they're supporting the regime, the same way as for many years Mubarak has been supported by the U.S. So now we're just having a change in many players, who's supporting who, and now we're going into more of the support of the Gulf, which is more any religious or conservative aspect of it.
Yes, I'm glad you raised the issue of Saudi Arabia. I think it gets overlooked because it's been so grim for so long, and it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed for the worse, partly because it's hard to get worse than it is. And you know, Freedom House, it has in its freedom ratings, our more most general categories are free, partly free, and not free. But even within the bottom category, we have the absolute bottom, which we call the worst of the worst. And I think Saudi Arabia has sort of been there pretty consistently for the last 40 years. The response I talked about, the sort of the backlash against the Arab awakening, has been quite visible throughout the Gulf countries. And I think much of that is supported, if not driven, by Saudi Arabia. We see that very visibly in Bahrain, where it was literally a military intervention to put down a peaceful uprising.
Regarding the Saudi Arabia, when we speak about the Arab Spring, we should not understand that what's the Arab state, 22 countries, which who are a part of the Arab League. 7 of them still monarchies. They don't have any democratic procedures in any way. And 5 of them in the Gulf countries. This is why it's very optimistic when we speak about the Arab Spring. Let's just start with these 5 countries, then when we move to the Gulf, it's a different story. There is a huge changes and dynamics within the Saudi society, and no one can ignore that. Let's see about literature, novelists, which very they speaking about unspeakable issues before, sex, relationship, men, women, and all of that. And this is a new trend within the Saudi society. The second issue, of course, the Saudi who are studied abroad. We have more than 40,000 Saudi students who now studying and studied in United States, according to the agreement between the Bush administration and the King Abdullah. This 40,000 students is not a small number. And that's when they got the country, of course, there's many institutions and they have key positions that will change. But with the same time, the problem in the leadership in the royal family, that's all above 80 years old. It's very old leadership. And this is the difficulties they are facing. And when you meet with some officials, with the Saudi scholars, they explain this is the situation. But the new player, no active player here in the region is Qatar. Qatar, it's now very, very active diplomacy, not only in the region, around the world. This is the only country they have Al Jazeera brand, in Arabic and English, which they can, it's number one regarding not only in Africa, in Southeast Asia. They have very active role in many key countries. And this is why I think a lot we should be talk about the Qatar. The second question regarding the Iraqi refugees, most of them they back to Iraq. But still some of them in the areas which still not effective, which very now in the heart of Damascus, but still difficult, of course, to get statistics or number about those refugees. But the UNHCR mentioned many times the Iraqi refugees, and that's the possibilities to protect them. The last questions, the reconciliation. We host a conference in last January about transitional justice in Syria, and we established what's called the Priority Committee for Transitional Justice. It has Alawites, Druze, and Christian women in these 14 members in the committee to set up programs regarding the transitional justice and the reconciliation in the future. Myself was among the early scholars in the Arab region who speak on transitional justice since 2005, and we set the programs. Now this is the time for Syria to do that. We understand there is difficulties, especially with the ongoing crimes against humanity and war crimes, very difficult to deal with the issue. But I think you have to start early, you have to set up programs. But again, because Syria have to raise again. Syria, it's a country of diversity, country of pluralism, and everyone has to understand that, has to accept the others to be part of the future Syria.
Just abuse my privilege, Mr. Chair, just 2 seconds to ask you another follow-up question on that in terms of transitional justice. And I think it's a difficult question. What if, I don't think it's likely to happen, but Assad were to say tomorrow, I'll step down, let's have a constituent assembly, let's talk, I've given instructions to the troops to stop shooting, but in exchange, I want an amnesty for me and all my generals from any prosecution for human rights violations. What do you think should be the response of the Syrian opposition?
Yes, no one can speak on behalf of the victims.
Right.
No one can give amnesty to anyone who committed crimes and war crimes against his own people. This is why even not the head of the opposition or anyone. And we help establish the organization for the victims of the Syrian revolution, which they have 19 members of, let's say, the samples of the martyrs of the Syrian revolution who have been killed in the early stage. And the main goal of this organization to speak about justice. Because I understand from an expert there is no complete case of transitional justice, even that in South Africa or in any countries. It has to be a bargain. And this is a politicians who can decide at the end. Because if you, the Syria is a good example of that. If the any transitional government after the fall of the Assad regime decided to try all of murders and who's been committed crimes, it will be long, long list.
Right.
And this is because vast majority of those are belong to the Alawite community, then this actually process will be seen as a punishment to the Alawite community rather than a transitional justice. Or this is what I said in many occasions, that in the best case example in divided societies like in Syria to go on international level, to go to the ICC International Criminal Court or to have international court. Because the case of Saddam Hussein before, who's a criminal and dictator, but because there is in his trial did not meet any of the international standards, being seen as a sign of punishment of the Sunni community. And we don't need to give Bashar al-Assad this privilege. We need to have a good standard trial for him, because not only the Syrians, the international community, to see the crimes and the war crimes he committed. This is why we said in the Transitional Justice Committee that the first we have to work to hold a transitional or international trial. If not the ICC, because the division within the Security Council and Russia and China will not allow, should the United Nations work with any transitional government in future to have international tribunal? It can be hybrid, like what's happened in Cambodia and in other cases, but it has to have international dimension because this is the best way to start with the Syria in the future.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, just I think that the other part of the Pakistani lady question was about Yemen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about Yemen. I was in Yemen several times. The first time I went to Yemen was in 94 after the war took place between the north and the south. And the north occupied the south, and this is how Yemen became one country. When I went to the north of Yemen, I found that 80% of the people in the north of Yemen are illiterate people. 80%. Then I came to one of the editors of the biggest newspaper there, and I asked, Muhammad, tell me why people are so illiterate here. Then he started laughing, and they said, why you are laughing? He said, people are so primitive in North Yemen because we never been occupied by any country in the world. So I am, as a Palestinian, became so proud that I was occupied by the Turkish, by the British, by the Jordanians, and by the Israelis. Thank you.
Okay. So let's take a final round of questions, I think.
Thank you very much. I had a small question with regards to the role of Russia and Iran through Hezbollah in the Syrian conflict. And I was wondering if on the panel you can share with us a few concrete steps you think we here in the West can take in order to have some positive movement in that front.
Any other questions? Yes, I can see one or two or three, please.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Collins. I'm one of the young leaders from the United States. I'd like to build on the question of national reconciliation and ask about some of the legislation that's being considered in Libya and Tunisia to exclude members of the former regimes from politics. In your view, where should the line be drawn? Is this a way to prevent backsliding, or is it some sort of political exclusion that goes too far? Thank you very much.
Hello.
Okay, one last question.
I want to ask Ms. Salam. The woman, there are several women's groups in Egypt. Do you all have the same vision? Do you all speak in one voice when you ask for your own rights? Or how do you work together, or how does that work? Thank you.
Who wants to start?
You can start with Syria to continue.
Yeah, so Iran.
Yes. I led two delegations from the Syrian opposition to Moscow. And I met twice with the Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Lavrov. In these two meetings, which lasted more than 2 to 3 hours, I felt myself that I'm in the Syrian regime, Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs, because he's been repeating the same arguments. We've been clear to him that we all share the same interest. We don't need Syria to go to the civil war. We need to save Syria. Your interest may be at least not the United States or any Western governments will provide us with the weapons or with the tanks, and we have to rely for maybe the next 10 years on the Russians, tanks and rockets and all of that. This is what we share the same interest. But at least you have to show some interest in that, in the main question that if the Assad stay in power, that the country itself will go in the wrong direction. But he's been again and again repeating the same argument that this is a terrorist organization, this is a terrorist group. Then I found myself that I'm in the wrong place. Because the Russians, even that they are proud of the Russian Revolution in 1917, but they hate the revolution word. And this is why always when we mention world revolution, he jump up and correct to us. This is not a revolution, and we don't know. Now. And this is they are very worried about their situation on this regard. This is why I said in many media interviews that we should give up, not to try more and more with the Security Council, because there is no any indications or signs in change of the Russian. And when I hear some European officials or the American officials, we have to do more on Russia, that means we have to keep the stalemate. Because it's been 2 years, and if the Russians, they need to make any change, they should do. It's not like by doing some statements, by changing their behavior at the Security Council. I don't care about their statements. Every day they say different things. But I do care about if there is change in their behavior at the Security Council. Even that their vote at the UN Human Rights Council was very negative, which even that's about basic things, about protecting human rights, and we should not put politics at human rights in this regard. In Iran, it's a different story. Iran, from the day one, decided to supply with the Assad regime, with the equipments, civilians, equipments, and all of that. Now, more and more involved of Iran with the some revolutionary guards on the ground, helping the Assad regime. It's very hurting to the Iranian itself. When a country speak on behalf of Islam and doing the most bad things on behalf of Islam, supporting dictatorship, supporting the atrocities and massacres been there, that shows that Iran itself it hasn't any kind of really principles. It shows that it's very very pragmatic, very supportive to its own short interest.
I want to make a few comments about the international dimension, not just in Syria, but more broadly towards the situation in the Middle East. The attitude of Russia and Iran, you know, I agree with Radwan, that is very predictable. And so I think it's really up to the international community to step up and counter what they're doing. In the parts of, let me talk first outside of Syria. It's noteworthy that I think the international community's support has been, or engagement has been, limited to those countries that have introduced some measure of change. And even there, they could do more. But you look at, you know, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, the other monarchies. There's really no outside pressure to encourage reform. And I think part is still this old mentality that whether there's a new face or not, it's still an old Western policy of support the dictator and the dictator gives you stability. And I think that's not only, you know, let's say morally questionable, it's not even pragmatic because the societies are changing. And so I think a wise international policy recognizes that and tries to work with the agents of change, which I think ultimately will bring more stability than simply, you know, trying to keep a lid on it. In terms of Syria, I think it's the U.S. policy is sort of described as pragmatic or, you know, worn out by wars and entanglements in the Middle East. But even that, to my mind, is not terribly pragmatic because there already are severe consequences. The longer the situation goes on, the worse it gets. There's more spillover. So there will be consequences that the United States and the international community will have to deal with. And I think it's pragmatic to be more engaged now and early on to manage those consequences. I'm Radwan, and I've had an ongoing discussion about, you know, my skepticism that at least the U.S. administration is ready to step up. But I think there are indications that there's more and more pressure. I mean, there are reports that President Obama was advised by his Secretary of State, by his Secretary of Defense, and the CIA director to start arming moderate elements of the Free Syrian Army. More recently, Senator Carl Levin, who's generally been a very, hesitant about engagement, has essentially called for airstrikes on Syrian Army positions. So I think there is mounting pressure, at least in the U.S., and so keeping up the calls for greater U.S. And international intervention may, in fact, be somewhere.
Okay. My answer is quite short. Yes, there is a coalition of feminist organizations in Egypt. It includes the pure civil society organizations working on women's rights only or feminist organizations, but also human rights organizations who have a gender component in their work. Generally, we have minimum standards that we work on together. Like there are on the huge cases, we don't. We set up meeting. We have a common position for all of us because it's always better to have a collective move. But other than that, yes, we do have standard positions on several issues, but not everything, because that's why we are different organizations, because we have different views on detailed issues.
Well, that's democracy in the making, I suppose. Thank you very much for this excellent and lively panel, and I think we're due for lunch, so please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.